This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got.
Well, hello guys, this is Clint Locklear from Predator Control Group, doing a little trapping radio tonight. I'm going to talk about all kind of craziness when it comes to setting traps, public land, skunks, eye surgeries, and why we might have to start putting a warning on some of the lure makers out there. So, we're going to go and get started. First off, I want to really thank Chip publicly for standing in for the shows, and he may end up doing one more here pretty soon. I'm not sure. We're going to see how it goes. He knew that I was going through a little something, and he volunteered and stepped up to help me out. And Chip, I really appreciate that, brother. I really do.
the reason, guys, now, you know, when I listened to Chip's talking, and I knew that Chip has been in a gunfight before, but when he was that open with that much transparency on the show about Christmas, about the gunfight he got in, what his feelings were and all that type stuff, you know, guys, that's transparency. That's real. And a lot of stuff online today, it's all of what people want you to think about them or what you want to see about them. And to build this perception that it's probably about, you know, 10 stories taller than it really is. But what you heard from Chip, that was nothing but realness right there. And, you know, that takes a lot of guts to do that, especially with other guys, because most guys want to think that they're going to be, you know, John Rainbow or something, Rambo, when they go out and get, if they ever get in that situation. Now, the reason he's helped me, and like I said, transparency is important to me as I know it is to you. So I'm going to go ahead and tell you something. I went in to an eye doctor about 3 weeks ago to see if I was a candidate for LASIK surgery so I could go deer hunting and see a little bit better at distance. I come out of there with a degenerative cornea disease called Fuchs dystrophy. And apparently two cataract problems that I didn't know that I had. Now this led down the road of me trying to figure out what all this stuff is. And I've already went through one surgery in one eye over those two things. And by the time you hear this, I've been through my second surgery. Now the reason I didn't want Chip to say anything is, guys, it's really hard for me to do a lot of stuff more than just a few seconds on the computer because the corneas are swollen up and different things like that. So I'm being completely and open, honesty and respectful to you to let you know why Chip has been doing that. And at the same time, I'm asking for the same mutual respect back to me, because for the next couple of weeks, I'll let you know on Trapping Radio that everything turned out fine, which I'm sure it will. But if you start sending a lot of emails asking how I'm doing and stuff, it really taxes the eyes after this surgery that I'm getting. And that's the reason I didn't say anything up to this point. And still, though, please, you know, and I know that some of y'all are going to be curious about what's going on. You're going to try to, you know, make sure I'm okay. I appreciate that 100%. I really do. But if you would just restrain from that, it would mean a lot to me, because, you know, like I can get on Facebook every now and then and type something in and look at some stuff, but like to do the shows where I got to do the editing and all that, the computer's all screwed up in my vision right now because I've got one eye that they changed to short distance, and then the other eye's fighting it, and that's one of the things you're going to change on the other one, along with doing a lot of cuts and playing around with my cornea. But the swelling makes everything look very fuzzy and halo, and it gives me a headache to look at a computer. So if you would just not, you know, send a bunch of stuff, I would greatly appreciate it. Not that I don't want to hear for you or care about you thinking about me. It's just, it'd be a lot easier if it wouldn't. So if you would do that, I'd greatly appreciate it. Now, one of the topics we're going to cover tonight is I got a message that I'm getting ready to play. And this is a guy that thinks that me and Jeff Dunlap needs to put warning labels on our lures because some bad things can happen. Now, if you're using my lure, and I'm not talking for Jeff, you'd have to ask this. If you get coyotes doing unspeakable things to you or your house cat or anything else because you're using our lure, you know, that's not covered under any type of warranty. So this is my warning I'm giving you. But you, after you hear this, you'll kind of see what may, when you're using really good lure, guys, stuff happens. So this is kind of a tale that I got that I thought I'd pass on.
Hey, 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 hey. Listen to me. We got to talk about something that's pretty serious. Now, I think you know them F&T guys. They were up there on the interweb, and I found them, and they had this really cool stuff in there, so I made an order. I mean, it was crazy how good the service was. I placed the order, and about 20 minutes later, it showed up at my door. You talking about awesome service. Well, I was so impressed with that, I placed another order. So I get my first order, and I got this stuff called Dunlap Lures. And I don't know what in the world's wrong with y'all people in the trapping industry. I'm just new to this. So you need to help a brother out when it comes to this stuff. Well, the first thing that happens is I know I'm going beaver trapping the next day. I got my two conibears in the back of the old Ford pickup truck, and I'm going to go out there, and I put the Dunlap Beaver lure in the glove box, and I go inside the house. Next morning, I come out there, there's a hole chewed through my Ford pickup door, man. I'm telling you, it's the truth. I put it in the glove box. The beaver went through the door, got in the glove box, tore it all up. There's crap everywhere. I mean, that's some really good shit. Now, I will tell you that, but that's a little destructive on a man's equipment. Need to put a warning on that. And then, the next day, I open up this stuff he's got called Hellfire. Oh, Lordy, is that stuff nasty. You know, my wife left. I don't know if it's permanent. I don't know if she's coming back. The house stinks. But as she was screaming and waving her hands in the air, trying to get away from that stuff, a cow broke in through the back window, knocked me on the ground, and did unspeakable things to me. Unspeakable things. Y'all got to put a warning on this stuff so guys know when they get the good stuff that the crap's going to happen pretty quick and it can be uncomfortable. Now, I get this other order in. And it's this stuff called Cat Collector. Now, I've got my little trap shed built out in the barn, so I go out there, my Fluffy, the house cat, big old male tomcat's out there, always nice as can be. I crack that jar of Cat Collector, and he comes up and he starts rubbing on my leg, and he starts pushing harder on my leg, and then my cat did unspeakable things to me. He started calling me his bitch and all kind of stuff, scared me to death. I closed the jar back up, put it in the refrigerator where I thought he couldn't smell it, and I go out there the next day and he's playing Barry White next to the refrigerator. I'm not sure what's going on. Put a warning label on this stuff, guys. Listen to me. Help a brother out.
Okay. Well, there you go. Maybe some lure makers need to put warning labels on their stuff. Don't know. Just say it. Okay, we're going to get into some questions here. There's, I've been saving these for when I come back for the show. So, they're pretty interesting stuff. And this one right here, the first one we're going to read is from JH. And I get this a lot, and so does a lot of other guys that people, you know, kind of look to sometimes for trapping information, and it's the time of year that it really starts becoming hot and heavy. So if you find this on your own trap line, guys, just breathe. We teach you a little trick about yoga. It's called deep breathing. You breathe in and you breathe out. And when you do that, it's hard to get upset. So, and that way you can think a little bit, but you just need to calm down when this happens to you a lot of times, because guys, this is just trapping. It says, Clint, I was wondering, do you prefer a walkthrough set over a cubby or vice versa? Recently, I had a few refusals. The cat walks in the trail. The camera turns on. The cat turns around and urinates on the set, but never commits to the cubby. What is it that I'm not seeing? And kind of basically what I said, this is trapping, man. Nothing close is 100% when it comes to animals. I use a cubby so I can control the feet and approach better. And I can see. And I would, at this point, change the visual of the set using flags, feathers, cotton, grass balls, or something, anything like that to make the cat more interested in the set since he's already seen it. Now, this is something that really, it seems to offend a lot of trappers. And I get everybody wants to be the best trapper, and whenever an animal comes by, you catch him. And that's like the end goal. You know, I'm sure that's like a guitarist wanting to be the best guitarist, and he plays all his life to be the best guitarist. But it's a goal that's worthy of striving for, but you're never going to reach it. You're never going to reach 100% when it comes to trapping with 100% of the animals. It doesn't matter what your technique is, what your set is, where your location is, what your lure bait is, what your flagging is, or anything. There's never been and never will be 100% when it comes to animals. But it's obvious from all of the questions and comments and stuff like that I get on Facebook and emails and phone calls, that when someone sees tracks, especially with coyotes, that comes, you know, within 2 or 3 feet of their set but doesn't commit, it just tears them up inside. Guys, that's trapping. That's going to happen. Don't let it bother you. If you've made a good set, you've got good lure and bait in your own location, pretty much the best thing you can do is absolutely nothing. Have patience. I've had sets that's been out for 60 days to catch a single surviving coyote before it ever set step in. And that thing has been around so many sets that it's unbelievable. So that's just what it is. Not all coyotes are interested in what you're doing every day. Just like you're not interested in the same thing every day. You can make an analogy with food or TV shows or going to the movies or whatever. It's just not the same. Like if you're fishing and every day you bottom fish, sooner or later you're going to go and use a bobber or throw a bait caster or something like that. And the fish that are looking at you are going to be trying to figure out why you're not, you know, doing what you want. They want you to do because you're not 100% either. That's just the way it is. Now, I will say this. From what this email says, when I looked at it again, he had a trail cam up, which is smart, which we've talked about that before. And then the cat walks into the trail, and then the cat turns around and urinates on the set but never commits. Now, when I'm at demos, I am always amazed at the shock and horror and the mental torment that goes on when I get to the part of my cat set where my first trap is 18 inches away from my attractant in my lure. Because that goes against everything that we pretty much always have ever seen when it comes to making sets. You know, some of them are right against the hole, some are 6 inches back, 9 inches back, you know, something like that. But if I'm putting two traps in for a cat set or a single trap, the very first one is always going to be 18 inches, which means if I'm using the bigger traps, my second trap's like 22, 24 inches away from my attractant. Now, part of it is for what this email is talking about. If you have your trap up close to the hole, like you're trying to make the Tooth Fairy Unicorn Dream hypothesis of a set that catches everything and it's really not that good for anything, and you're trying to generically have trap locations and stuff like that, this is what happens to you. As I see, a cat set to me is a cat set, and part of the habits of a cat is they have a tendency to hang up about 16 inches away from a set. From me keeping a journal for all them years going to Texas for the first 3 or 4 years, when I had a misstep and didn't catch one, they seemed to hang up about 12 to 14 inches. 16 inches, somewhere around there. I mean, I was bringing out tape measurements after a while to see what it was. That's why at 18 inches. So if the cat is going to pee on the set, he's going to have to do it from a foot and a half away before he can get away from the way that I block it up. You know, the other thing is the way that I use, and you can go on my YouTube channel, guys. Wolfer Nation is a YouTube channel. It's got all kind of free videos on there, and you can see demos that I've done at NTAs and state conventions and footage from the field where I'm making cat sets, the way that I do my blocking. If he's going to commit to that set, he's got a 7-inch shoot, and he better not get within 2.5 feet of that set or he's in trouble. Because whatever he does at that at the minimum of 18 inches away from that set, he's already caught. So, and if he happens to somehow get around that and he goes in and pees on your set, now he's got to bring 4 paws back out over that trap, blocked in the way it is, he's in trouble. So, you know, when I'm doing what I'm doing on my bobcat sets, it's not because it's my thing or the way that I like to do it. As you can see on my cat collector, my video, the 4-hour one, it's because cats react a very consistent way at a set. And by bringing that way back and the blocking the way that I do it on there, he's going to have a hard time peeing on one of my trap sets from a foot and a half to 2 feet away. It's really, really hard. You know, and like I said before, I had a student once that expanded this out to 2.5 to 3 feet, and he was still racking. He actually caught more cats than I did with footholds that year. You know, I think he did like 170 or something. It was insane. But that's what he was doing, is he was doing my shoot or my set and extended out to 2.5, 3 feet. because he was having some refusals at 20 inches or 18 inches or wherever he was at the time. So it makes a big difference, not only how you make your set, but why you make your set the way that you do. You know, one of the things that students get really nervous when I used to give instruction is, you know, I really didn't care if you had a bad reason why you were doing something. I just want to know the reason that you're doing something. And what I learned from giving all those hours of instruction in all the schools is most people don't have a reason why they do what they do. They just do it. And then, so what you're doing is, when you're doing that, it's hard to fix a problem because you don't have a reason or why what you were doing anyway. So then all of a sudden you get in a pickle. So, but the main thing, guys, is if you've got a good set that's on good location with good lure and an animal doesn't commit to that set, probably the worst thing that you can do is start screwing with it. Now, bobcats are one of the few things that I would say is different. If a bobcat doesn't work your set or does work your set and then get caught, then you need to change something the way it looks. And that's just because the way that a cat thinks. Once it's already got its curiosity filled, very rarely does the same cat go back to the same set. Now, you can change it up. You can, just put different feathers in the back or hang cotton off or a fishing lure or, you know, change lures out or put a bunch of urine in it or droppings. But you need to do something to get that thing to look at it from a different point of view. And then it'll normally work the set again, especially bad on she's. And she won't work the set again. So that's the only time I'm going to say. But if you're working coyotes and fox and stuff and everything's the way it's supposed to be, don't mess with it. You know, it's just one of those things. You got an animal that eventually is probably going to do the wrong thing at what you consider not the best optimal time because it's not the very next day when you're going back to look at the set. But if you got everything wired tight, you're probably going to catch that animal no problem whatsoever. So, you know, that's definitely one thing to look at on there. So we're going to go to this next question, which is an interesting question that brings up some stuff, but you may or may not be shocked at my answer. I'm not sure.
Hey, Clint, it's Gabe. I was really hoping that you all could have a conversation here on Trapping Radio about public land, specifically about the debate that's going on right now between federal land and state land. I have strong beliefs about that. I want the states to be in charge of the wildlife. But especially out west, I really don't mind the federal government having the public land. I think that there is a good reason for mixed ownership. I think we have a great way of doing it here in Tennessee where we do have a lot of state-owned land and it gets used a certain way. But we also have some federal land and it causes us to have a diverse way to interact with nature around us. But I was wondering what your thought was on the controversy out of the federal government divesting itself of public land. Thank you all and have a great show.
Well, when it comes to the government, I'm a simple creature, guys. I really am. One, I am a libertarian, not what you saw this year in the election, not the Yahoo that was running, not anything like that, but a true libertarian. I don't want you messing with me. I don't want you to be responsible for me. I don't want to be have you do anything that I think is right or wrong, and I don't want to be responsible for you. Pretty simple. You know, what I believe individual freedom is. I'm also borderline an anarchist. And if you don't know what that is, and you just sucked in some air when I said that, anarchy is not like the movie Purge or when you hear the government always talking about anarchy where it's just people killing old people and robbing and raping. If you've never looked in what true anarchist is, or anarchism, it's just mean leaderless. It doesn't mean rules and doesn't mean you abuse people. It's more like a governed system where the people have a lot more responsibility and there's not a power structure that we have, so people just always look for power. You know, it's a very interesting thing. But when it comes to the government, I'm very constitutional. I believe that either with divine help or divine guiding, that the people that wrote the Constitution, the way that it ended up, is about the best way that a government of a large land size can be ran. And it's very clear in the Constitution. And when you hear people talk about the Constitution, I don't think they exactly look at it right. The Constitution limits the government, but opens up everything to the individual unless they're going to break basic rights, or they're going to try to do something that's going to harm or take advantage of somebody else. And so the Constitution, to me, is, I'm not going to say sacred for the same, but as far as, it's the first time in history, guys, that a government built itself that way. Now, the Constitution, nowhere is about them owning lands or having federal parks or anything. Because if you think about it from a constitutional point of view, what right does the government have to keep land away from the citizens that actually own the country? That's the way that I personally look at it. And I feel the same way for the states, but it's a little different for the states. All the power, see, everything a government's supposed to do is in the Constitution. Everything they're not supposed to do is up to the states, because it's a little bit more controllable for the population. That's where the state stuff is supposed to be ran. Now, if the states decide that they want to have public grounds or parks or whatever, and the people that they put in there, I think that's totally fine. See, that's extremely constitutional at that point. But the federal government owning lands, especially the way they do out west, and it's not for a military base or something like that, to me just doesn't make a lot of sense. If you go to a state like New Mexico, it's probably 80% federal and 20% private. Now, why does the government hold all that land? And for what purpose? Now, and I know that some people are going to say, well, it's so everybody can go enjoy it. But there again, I'm going to go back to the Constitution. If it's not in the Constitution, one of their things they're supposed to do, and in one of their amendments, then they shouldn't be doing it. That's the way I feel about it. Now, from just a personal point of view, just looking at it from the world that we actually live in, since the government does not follow the Constitution at all anyway, I mean, that's an absolute joke that they're the constitutional government, no matter who's been in presidency. Since they don't, it is nice to have like Yellowstone National Park and different things like that, people to go see. It's nice when I go out and visit relatives in Colorado and you have all this federal ground that you go hiking and biking on and stuff like that. So, and a lot of those they can hunt. I don't think they need to be as restrictive as they are in a lot of things, but that's what government always does, is they restrict everything. That's just like how they get the rocks off, it seems like. But, you know, in Tennessee, we have WMA, wildlife management areas. We have state parks. We also have Smoky Mountains, which is a federal park, which is, you know, I guess because you're used to that now, I'm kind of fine with it. It does give you a lot of different regulations and stuff you have to deal with. The part that bothers me about the federal stuff is you can break rules that you don't know you're breaking, and all of a sudden you're going to be classified as a felon a lot of times. That's very bad. They have different rules and different things like that that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But it's just the way it is. My view, and like I said, I'm gonna fall back to the Constitution, to be honest with you, man. And I don't know why the government owns any land except for maybe military installations or something that they're actively using at the time. Because if you live in New Mexico and you go to buy property or Colorado, it's so, so expensive. And the reason it's as expensive, or if you want to go buy land, you're probably not going to be able to afford it unless you're making, you know, $200,000 or $300,000 a year, is because since the government owns all of it, except for a small percentage, what is left causes an undue burden on the population that actually lives there. That's why housing is so expensive and rent is so expensive. and everything else is so expensive. They're big states. Land shouldn't be hard to get as it is in those states now. It should be easy to get, and it's not. You know, it's unintended consequences of the government's owning land is usually a lot more burdensome when you look at it from a different perspective of I just want to go hiking somewhere. You know, because I got really enchanted with New Mexico. But I mean, a $200,000 house in New Mexico is like a $30,000 house here. And it's in part of a city that you would not leave your wife at if you weren't there. I mean, it was so drastic, it was unbelievable. Now, for some of the ranchers that get BLM land, you know, there's a lot of fascistic type stuff that goes on with those type of leases. People that are buddies seem to get them a lot more than people that aren't buddies. And again, that's the way the government works. So, you know, as far as them giving the land back, I think it's smart. They probably can't afford all the stuff upkeep that they've got now because, for one, they're so inefficient when they do different things. So if they're giving the state backs or divesting, it shouldn't be money that's now going to be going into the federal government. It should be going back to the state, and the state then has the option of what they want or need to do with it. And then the people of that state should be able to vote on what's going on in their own state. That's the way that I think it should be. Now, I've been told several times that I'm like, you know, right of Genghis Khan when it comes to stuff like this. So I'm very close-minded when it comes to any government powers. And I'm very open-minded to having individuals. Because what type of industry or what type of farming or anything could be going on those state grounds or those federal grounds that can't happen because the government just waved a wand one day and decided they're going to take it? You know, like with Obama. With the power of doing that, he's locked up oil fields in Alaska for the simple reason for lobbyist money from green groups. Now, not for anything else, but now people that want to live there or want to do gold mining there or do anything, they can't do it. So, that, like I said, the unintended consequences most of the time really outweighs the public part to me. But that's, you know, that's just, you know, since I'm not president and I'm not king, you know, that's just my opinion, honestly. I think the state should have the right to do what they want to do with it because that's just the way our governing system, which was originally intended for the people to be in charge, was set up. So there you go on that one. Okay, now the next email I've got is something that I probably did not make clear enough. And this is from Chris H. And it's pretty interesting that, I mean, and it's kind of the way trapping starts for most people. You get all excited and you think you're going to go out and whoop the world. And then reality kind of kicks you in the teeth. And then you start getting your legs under you. And then things start to really go. So it says, "Hi, Clint. Great content all over the web from you and others. To those who help us and need the learning art of trapping. I'm 47 years old. This is my second year trapping. The first year was 2012. I couldn't even catch a cold this year. I want to try again after seeing some young coyotes on the edge of my yard during daylight hours that I later determined were coming to the persimmon tree that's there. Not my chickens or rabbits, although I'm sure they enjoy the fragrance emanating from that source. Anyhow, after 2 weeks of trapping, I finally connected with my first coyote. Congrats, man. That's always one of the most special ones you'll get. The next one will be the number 100. I'm hooked. From October 18, 27, I caught 16 canines, 13 coyotes, 3 gray fox. Dude, you're rocking it. This week leading up to November 27, I hammered them pretty good. I thought with 23 traps out over 160 acres. I had caught 6 canines, 2 which were gray fox. Since then, one of my first bobcats and absolutely nothing else. Hopes of becoming Clint Loppler of South Missouri is, I think it's Missouri, Mississippi. It's a weird abbreviation. So one of those two. It's probably not going to happen. But, dude, trust me. If I can go out and catch a lot of animals, anybody can go out and catch a lot of animals. I mean, that's just the truth. Okay. I continue seeking as much information as I can. Recently started listening to Trapping Radio, which is another great source of information. Thanks again. Last night I was looking through the archives and listening to Trapping Radio episode 96 with Randy Smith. Very good stuff. Then y'all said something about switching to snares in December because the coyotes just seem to stop paying attention to dirt holes during this time. I'm now studying to learn the art of snaring for the live market, so I'm assuming it's Mississippi. At first I thought that 16 catchers is just going to run out of animals to catch, but I'm still seeing tracks, so they're not just ignoring my sets. I could ask more questions, and it goes on and on, but the main question is, when me and Randy, and I haven't went back and listened to it, but I'm pretty sure, knowing Randy, he's a very observant trapper too, that Chris, the big thing, which I tried to explain a little bit in my email I sent back, but I'm going to elaborate on that a little bit. When coyotes start getting Randy for breeding season, they're just like bucks that are in rut. They have one thing on their mind, and it's female companionship. And if they get a companion, then they switch over to needing to lock up a territory to raise pups. Now, they do eat during this time. They're not monks or anything that go on a long fast, but they're more concentrated on the mission of getting a girlfriend and then getting a territory and then defending that territory. So a lot of the hunting that can go on in a more lackadaisical way over long periods of time, it seems to me, once they change that focus, that the dirt holes and the flat sets and stuff like that really slow down. Now, you will still catch them if you have enough patience. But what happens during this time of year, it gets really frustrating to a trapper, because all of a sudden he's doing really good and it just seems like everything falls apart. And you're not doing anything different. You're using the same set, same lure, same location, same techniques, same trap line management, same everything. And then all of a sudden it seems to start going south. And normally that's when, because coyotes are changing their mind. Now normally during breeding season, there's like a 10-day period. It's almost dang near impossible to catch any amount of coyotes in numbers. Most guys that I know that are real serious about coyote trapping, they go trap something else. I mean, it's just really, really bad. You know, if you're farther south and this is Mississippi, that may be February that you find this. And when you see it, like I said, most guys that really hammer coyotes, instead of fighting against that, they just go away. But the way to still catch fur is take what they want to do out of the equation. So during this, when you start seeing, and I'm not talking about one or two coyotes. Now, please don't confuse what I'm saying, guys. I'm not saying you got sets out and today you see a coyote walk by a set and then you're not running a whole lot of sets and 4 or 5 days later you see a coyote running down the sets and, oh, this is where I got to start doing that. That's not what I'm saying. When you consistently, time after time after time, see coyotes that are walking by sets, see, this is where a human has an advantage. We have the ability to reason. And if coyotes are not thinking about the same things they do 10 months out of the year, as a reasoning human being, we have an advantage of we can now look at that and figure out what's going on and switch. And the way to switch where the coyotes' wants are taken completely out of the equation is go to snares and go to blind sets and trails. Because coyotes will still use the same trails, the same roads, the same cover edge, going through the fence, everything like that. But they're working their territory in a different way. And that's irrelevant to the trapper if he's using a snare or a blind set. Because all you need a coyote to do at that point is be where he's going to be. And since you can reason as a human, you set stuff that's going to allow him to get caught even when he doesn't realize he's doing anything but going down a trail. And that's the reason that you switch more when you start seeing this. You start switching more to snares or blind sets. And it's a lot more work in a state that you can't set snares. I mean, you can go out with kill poles or snare supports and long snares, and you know, you can really put out a lot of snares. To do that with blind sets, it's a whole lot slower. So if you're in a state that you can't snare, you are at a disadvantage, but it's still something you can consistently take coyotes on, probably just not on the same scale as someone that can go out and start running snares. You know, that's just the way that it is. So that's why when you go to the snares and the blind sets, it doesn't matter what his mind is thinking when he's on that trail. If he steps on a blind set, he's caught and he don't even know it. And if he's going down a trail, you got it blended in good in the right locations. Most of the coyotes, not all, because nothing's 100%, most of the coyotes will still get caught even though they wouldn't work a dirt hole that was 2 foot away from there. You know, so that's the reason we go to that. It's just because their mind's in a different place, apparently. I mean, I've never been able to interview one where they gave me any answers, but that's just logically looking at over the years what seems to happen. And you can see it in other animals. You can see it in rams and sheep. You can see it in deer and elk and everything else. You know, once that time comes, they just don't eat or work the food as much and stuff like that because they got one thing on their mind. So that's why. Okay, now this is a question I've never really thought about in the way that this is being asked. And I kind of like that because it's something I've just never really thought about. I will tell you something before we get started. Let me go and read this, then I will. Hi, Clint. Hope you had a very Merry Christmas. Thank you again for producing Trapping Radio and putting out all the information for trappers. I have to say it helped me more than on more than one occasion. I do have a question for you, though. This also may make a good radio show for trappers to learn from. Over the years, my trap line for coyotes, fox, and bobcats, I've had the opportunity numerous times to come face-to-face with Mr. Skunk waiting in my trap. I used to see this as an aggravation, but now I'm starting to see the skunk in the trap would be a good thing and somewhat profitable for the trapper. I've never intentionally targeted skunks in the past, but I'd like to start running a late-season line for the Luggerburgers, and I don't know how much experience you have with skunks, but could you point a trapper in the right direction on how to target skunks? I'm all of a sudden looking around trying to see what state you're in. Okay. Would it be body grips, footholds, DP, cages? What baits and lures would you use for skunk? What are locations you would look for when targeting just skunks and woodlands and farmlands? Also, can you cover trapping skunks throughout the trapping season, especially late winter and February? And of course, what is the value of a skunk to a trapper and to a lure maker, and what is the best way to market the skunks you catch? Thanks, Clint, for answering these questions and other stuff he says about DVDs and different things. So, Dan, I've never really went out and just targeted skunks. I've done it a little bit in conjunction with other things, like I've trapped on some of my clients have had quail plantations, and skunks are a big deal with them. And the way I went about it, it seemed, I mean, because I don't have a lot of experience of just targeting skunks, seemed to be very productive, at least for what I was doing. So, but before I do that, I want to tell you a funny story. Or somewhat of a funny story if you know who this is. Now, Red O'Hearn, if you've ever met him or you see him at a convention, guys, you need to go talk to him. He's a wealth of information. He's funny. He's smart. And he's just a great guy. But Red O'Hearn is known for coon trapping. And he is a master at coon trapping. And I'm talking, you know, 1,000 in a couple of weeks type coon trapper. And he's got coon pinned down beyond anything else I've ever seen, the way that he knows about coons. But I heard him say one time, because skunk pelts were getting up to $5 and $6 a piece, and they seem to cycle that out over 2 or 3 years. And Red, being an entrepreneur, he started really thinking about, and I don't know if he ever did this, but he thought about when coons were down in price just to be a skunk trapper. And the reasons were, there's a lot of things, which I'll go ahead and cover right now. You've got the fur, so if it's worth $3, $6, $10, depending on the size and the color. You can tan them. They sell actually pretty well tanned. People just like having a skunk in their house. It's a good conversational piece. You know, you can probably turn that after you tan it into $20, $30 profit by doing that. The oil of a skunk has got market value depending on what you're doing as far as some lure makers. I use it in one of my products. I get it from Red. So I don't need any more. He keeps me filled up with plenty. But I think I'm paying, if I'm not mistaken, $65 a gallon. And if I'm not sure, but I think he strips all the fat off the skunks and everything when he fleshes, puts it in barrels, lets it rot down till it gets to this. It's a brown consistency that can get hard, but it feels kind of like, if it's just normal temperatures, like an icing, I guess. It's a brown color. It's got a weird flavor. It's got a very unique property that if a lure maker knows enough about what he's doing, he's going to know what that property is. Another place that you could probably sell that would be to people that raise horses and race horses, believe it or not. They buy that if it's good quality and it's rendered out well and stuff, because it won't smell like skunk. The property that it has is very unique. So it's got a couple of different markets there. You've got the essence that, you know, that price seems to bounce depending on what's out there, from, you know, $10, $12 to $20 an ounce for lure makers and other stuff like that. Don't forget about garden trade people and deer people and everything else. There's a lot, skunk goes in a lot of different things. You've also got the after you take the skunk essence out of the sacks itself, it's a really unique product. It calls what a lot of people call sweet musk. It's got a lot of different names. But you take those and you just let them rot down. And eventually what will happen is they will turn into like an oil type consistency. And it will have a sweet smell, believe it or not, with an undertone of skunk. And it's a pretty good coyote ingredient in lures and baits. So, you know, I don't know what people pay for those. I catch enough that I don't really have to do that by accident. But I'm sure you can call around to people that would want it or already have the product ready, and you could probably sell it somehow. I don't know what it is that it's how it's sold or what it costs, but there's definitely a product there that you can sell the skulls to a lot of people because there's a cool looking skull. Different things like that I can just think of right off the top of my head. So actually, if you strip a skunk down, and that's what Red was doing, was thinking about all the oil, all the oil essence, the sacks, the fur, everything. If you do it that way, I would say a skunk is probably really worth probably about $20 to $30, at least $20, and they're a lot easier to catch. So I think it's a neat topic. We don't have a tremendous amount of skunks around here where I trap at, but I've been places like in Iowa that, I mean, that's a skunk factory. Because you run a bunch of 220s, and back when I was there was running 280s, you put those in trails, I mean, you're killing sometimes 10, 15 a day, and you're not trying to. So that's one way to look at that. But the best way that I found to quickly do it, well, there's two ways. In Texas, what I learned very quickly, if you put the Freedom Brand dog proofs up next to where there's spoil piles, where you take pieces of wood, you know, where you're cutting timber and clearing land and you pile up and you got those big piles, you see them on farms everywhere, skunk love those things. And so, but coons do too. So you see a trail going in there, and I didn't know if it was skunk or a coon. So I put the DPs, if it was skunk, the skunk was there. If it's coon, a coon was there. So the Freedom Brands really did what they were supposed to do for me. So you can use a skunk set using purely DPs. You really could. And it would be a very practical way to go. Now, if your state allows you to do this, I think probably the slickest and fastest way to be a professional skunk trapper, if you want to go this route, would be something like using really small buckets or mailbox things, and then you can put in 160s or 220s or maybe even 120s in there. Put something that's really stinky in the back, you know, and it could be sweet. I would say if I was going to come up with a skunk lure, which I don't have, but if I was going to start testing one, I would want to make it where it would be almost something like really good Chinese food. I'd want it very sweet, and I'd want it very sour on the back end. So something that would be very sweet could be, say, Loganberry, and something that would be very sour on the back end could be, I don't know, something maybe as simple as fish sauce, like that you put in Chinese food, actually, and mix that with a good catfish oil or something like that, and play around with something like that till you figured out what really the skunks like. But I'd want to have a sweet punch and a sour punch, and I'd want it to have it where it was thick, so I'd need a base that would go into, which could be meat, which would be fine. And if you're going to do that, then I would have it where it was really good and tainted. I would throw that in the back of the bucket. What I was using when I was doing that on the quail plantation was just predator bait. And I would just throw the predator bait in the back, and I would put I was using 220s in little boxes, and I would put them down, and I would put them in thick areas where, you know, like right up next to tree lines, up next to those spoil piles, up next to old buildings, old well houses, around the feeders, if it was a deer place or a quail feeder. A lot of the skunks would come up and play around those things. Thicker areas, not so much just out in the open. You'd always want to have it up cover. It's when it seemed to work the best. Long fence lines, different things like that. And the skunks just found them and got in them. And, you know, we did very well with it, even though that, like I said, I didn't put a whole lot of thought into it. It was just one of those things. And it's good or bad, whether you want them. You're also going to be a possum king if you do that. So that's one way to do it. I do think, though, that if a trapper were to find markets for all those different products, and maybe even spend the money to have the fur tanned, he could probably turn, especially if he tanned the fur, he could turn every skunk into $30 profit. Now, when you look at the lengths people go to catch $30 raccoon when you have the competition. Now, see, what was interesting about what Red was saying, to me anyway, is when coon prices go down, catch the skunks. Now, I don't know if that meant he was going to tan all of them or he was going to just sell the fur, but there's a couple of ways to look at this. Now, you can look at it from the point of view of, okay, you're going to put the skunks up because you're going to, anyway, so you're going to flesh them, and then you're going to send them to the tannery. If you didn't want to spend the money, or you couldn't afford to spend the money to get, you know, a couple hundred skunks tanned, one option you would always have on that is to store that fur until the market is right. You know, we've talked about this several times in the past. It's your product. Sell it when the price is right, not when it's low. So if skunks seem to, and possums are the same way, they seem to be on, you know, 3 or 4 year roller coaster ride. So what if for 3 years you just stack skunk pelts, stored them, and then when their time is right, you dump them on the market at the highest price? I think you would come out a lot better than most people realize. You know, because some years even possums are $4 and $5 for good ones. Well, as easy as they are to flesh and as easy as they are to catch, I can only assume that skunks would be the same way. I haven't put up a ton of skunks, to be honest with you. Most of the time I bury them at another predator set or something. But, you know, I'll take the estes and stuff out. But that's definitely one way to think about it. And I think with a low market, I think it's smart to start looking at stuff like this, to be honest with you. It really is. It's a cool way to bump up a profit from an activity you enjoy. Now, I will say, I did like the body grips because the skunk was dead, and I didn't have to mess with it when I was there. Now, you do lose some of the essence. If you were going to get really, really serious about this, you could use the same thing with a small trap, like a 1.5, you know, just a 2-cold 1.5 trap. You can wire it off or whatever you wanted to do. But if you're going to try to keep every bit of essence out of that thing, you're going to have to dispatch it where it doesn't spray. And now you're going to be into carrying one of the poles that the ADC guys use, the kind that shoot the juice in there. Some use acetone, they use other stuff. But they actually go through the rib cage of the skunk when it's alive. They talk to it, tell them how pretty it is and how good of a day everything's going. They get him nice and calm. And then they get the plunger right up next to him with a needle and the skunk, because the skunk won't spray unless he thinks he's being threatened. And then they just push that through there. And most of the time, the skunk will not spray and it'll just pass away. And then you could get all of the essence out that way. I mean, guys, I've tried shooting them in the head. I've tried shooting them in the lungs. I've tried everything that every old myth has ever said, and every one of them almost sprays. I mean, I've even went to the point where down in Texas one year, I tried an experiment where I had my 308 Ruger Scout rifle, and at about 50 yards away, I would take their head, slap off, and they still sprayed. So even if you disconnect their head from their body in a nanosecond, they're still going to spray. So if you want to keep all of that, the plunger is with the acetone or the chemicals is going to be about all that you're going to be able to do. You know, if you catch them in cages, you could figure out some way to use carbon monoxide or something off your tailgate. You can come up with all kind of different ways. Cage traps for me are, if you have them, I would say that'd be a very unique way to catch them, because you could set them in a lot of places you probably wouldn't want to set a body grip trap or even a foothole. Get closer to town when people's talking about it, close to horse barns and cattle barns that are closer to town. Catch a bunch of them, and then you've got a lot better way to worry about dispatching them when all that's over with. That's a neat idea. I mean, I have to admit, if you really played your market right. And see, this is where it gets where critical thinking comes in, which I really like. Now, if you're going to look at this purely from a business point of view, if you know skunk essence over the course of, say, 5 years is going to be worth way more than it is now, and you're catching them, and it's not something you have to have the money to pay any bills with or eat, and it's just more fun money or just extra spending money. From a business point of view, wouldn't it be smarter to store the hides when you can sell them higher, have the sacks and find the lure makers to sell that to, the oil where to sell that to, and then the essence? Because I can tell you, I think it was last year, the year before, you couldn't find skunk essence. I had my own stuff, so I was okay, but a lot of lure makers, when the lure sales peaked because of the prices probably 3-4 years ago, I guess, the more I think about it, a lot more lure was sold and a lot more lure dealers ran out of skunk, but not a lot of people were catching or saving the skunks because the other fur was worth more money. It made the skunk that was on the market, the skunk essence, really get high. I mean, there was more of an average price of $20 an ounce than it was 10 or 12 or 14. And I've heard as much as 25 an ounce if you could get it. Now, see, from a business point of view, it doesn't go bad. You don't have to refrigerate it or freeze it. You take it out, you put it in what I like to put it in is old liquor bottles. Jim Beam seems to work the best. Scotch even gives a little bit better to me. But you put that in those liquor bottles, put the cap on it, give it a little bit of headspace, and forget about it. And then you kind of keep your ear out when the price is getting higher. You've got 2 or 3 years worth stored up, and the going rate's $20 and no one can find it. If you do a percentage basis of the difference between 12 and 20, you just absolutely beat anything the stock market can do in that amount of time, hands down, no questions asked, and all you had to do was strategically think about what you were doing. I mean, to me, that's the way to go, but it's totally up to you. Well, okay, guys, that's the last one that I'm going to do, and not sure if I will be doing next week or Chips will. I will probably try to. He may have to do the text and all that stuff for me, but we'll see what happens. And, you know, it's wintertime, guys. Go out there and have a good time. And just do what you want to do and enjoy the woods, because it is a right that you have that is very cool, and don't waste it.
I never cut tobacco in the hills of Tennessee. ain't got a moonshine still, but I still love to smoke and drink. No, I never ate dinner from a wood-burning stove, a rode bareback in a rodeo. If you wanna see the redneck side of me, give me a six-string flat-top guitar, put all you hillbillies in a honky-tonk bar. Show me to the stage and set me free. And I'll sing all night in the morning light. When your shades are on and your head's on ice, you'll know you'll sing the redneck side of me. I never was a roughneck. I've been crude down the line. All night long, no timber, sawing on them Georgia pines. I can't mix the best batch of etouffee. I never hunted gators in the Everglades. You wanna see the redneck side of me? Give me that six-string guitar, put all you hillbillies in a honky-tonk bar. Show me to that stage and set me free. And I'll sing all night and the morning light. When your shades are on and your head's on ice, you'll know you sing the redneck side of me. In a smoke-filled bar, show me to that stage and set me free. We'll raise hell all night in the morning light. When your shades are on and your hat's too tight, you'll know you sing the redneck side of me. Oh, give me that six-string flat-top guitar, put all you hillbillies in a honky-tonk bar. Show me to the stage and set me free. We'll drink all night and the morning light. When your shades are on and your head's on ice, you'll know you sing the redneck side of me.